Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is episode 65 and it is the 22nd of June. We got a huge, huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to Dr. Peter Hendy.
Not to be mistaken with Lifesaver Trevor Hendy. Not Lifesaver. Surf Lifesaver, yeah, Trevor Hendy. Yeah, you know the triathlete. Trevor Hendy.
Yeah, do not, out there, if you think we're talking to a very obscure triathlete from yesteryear,
you've
come to the wrong place.
He was the best.
So we're going to be talking to former Liberal Party MP, Dr. Peter Hendy.
Trevor Hendy thinks we should cut tax as well. Sorry, carry on.
He wants to run through it. So Dr. Peter Hendy, former Liberal Party MP, we're going to be talking about tax. No, we are going to be talking about his new book, Why Australia Slept. And we are also going to be talking to him about some of the reform packages that Australia could be looking at to launch ourselves. And we're also going to be talking to one of our favourites, IPA Policy Director Simon Breeny.
In the top 100.
Top 100 staff members we've had on the show. And just in that list. We're going to be talking to him about ABC privatisation, the big story of the week. We're also going to be talking about Coles and Woolworths banning plastic bags, or stopping giving out complimentary plastic bags, probably. And his recent trip to Ireland. But let's get into it, Pete, because ABC privatisation. Oh, sorry, as always, we're joined by the best button presser in the game, Nina Lowen Arthur.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Nina, is this definitely recording? Because I cannot have another podcast die on me today. It's been two or three.
It should be
recording. The red button means good.
Yeah.
That's all I know.
Well, we can check after this.
We can be talking to no one.
Yeah, if the podcast, like, we got a lot of podcast listeners who like it at that 2 p.m. slot that it usually comes out on, and it's currently, what, 3:11, so... we've had some bad ones.
It's a podcast life.
Yeah. It comes with the territory. And it would melt worse podcasters than us. It would have them on their knees.
But Pete and if there were worse podcasters than us.
Pete and I stand tall.
That's right.
We embrace the challenge.
We're brave.
We come back harder.
We're really brave.
We come back stronger.
Anyway.
Let's get into it.
According to The Guardian.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you've seen. I thought you said let's get into it.
I was going to set it up for you. But according to. All right. Let's get into the analysis. Pete, sorry.
Well,
I'll just sit idly by.
Readers of The Guardian and the ABC this week might have read that the IPA has sold the ABC to North Korea. No, just kidding. Well, I don't know, maybe. But obviously on the back of Professor Sinclair Davidson and Dr. Chris Berg's book Against Public Broadcasting in the last couple of weeks, there's been this discussion about the privatisation of the ABC. The Young Libs put a motion to the annual conference of the Liberal Party earlier in the week or last week saying we should privatise it. It passed. The quote was full privatisation of the ABC except for services into regional areas. We featured in Hey What Did I Miss Yesterday a video from Sinclair Davidson on Sky News, on Outsiders, saying that the ABC was out of touch with mainstream Australia, which is true because all their journos are greenies. This has obviously caused all the ABC journos to go bananas. My favourite tweet was this fantastic economic analysis from Emma Alberici, the purveyor of economic analysis, putting aside the fact that ABC News is never going to be sold. Worth remembering that if the ABC disappeared today, our commercial rivals would not generate one extra cent of revenue. We don't take their revenue. If we were privatised, on the other hand, we would.
Yeah. Cool. Let's discuss this. Let's discuss. So ABC has a market share, right?
Correct.
But if they went, there'd be no changes to anyone else's revenue, despite the more market share.
Well, if
get.
They went, she's saying they would take their rivals' market share.
Oh. So, Pete, doesn't make sense.
I don't know. If she said it, must be true.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. So, yeah, ABC privatisation has been a huge issue that the IPA has been looking at for a number of years now. People might remember, long-time members of the IPA might remember that it was part of our 75 Ideas to Transform Australia way back in 2011. And that got a lot of controversy then, got a lot of controversy now. But the difference about this time is when you've got like a pretty peak council in the Liberal Party talking about ABC privatisation and voting for it, that's probably the closest, certainly since I started reading about politics, probably the closest that Australia's ever come to really discussing and debating ABC privatisation. So it's starting to garner a bit of momentum.
That's right. And it's sort of like, you know, oh, well, this will obviously never happen. But I mean, maybe it will. You know, like that's the commentary. Oh, this will never happen, but blah, blah, blah. But this is how you get things to happen.
Yeah.
Politics is a long game.
It's a long game.
You know, I'm an old war horse of the Australian.
It's been around the tracks a few times.
Trust me, it's a long game.
And this is how revolution starts, not with a bang, but with a whimper.
Don't know, not that one. But it's like, you know, climate change, you know, the science is settled and now, like, no one believes in climate change anymore.
Yeah, I don't think
so.
I
mean, obviously heaps and heaps of people do.
And the climate is changing, but yes, I get it.
You understand what I'm saying.
Cool. So we're talking about a bit more about ABC privatisation with Simon Breeny later in the show. But if you guys do want to know more about it, so if you're new to the show, we interviewed Dr. Chris Berg, author of the book, what is it? Against Public Broadcasting, The Case for Privatising the ABC.
Very good.
New book, out in Cotter Court. We talked to Chris Berg, who's one of the authors, on the podcast about a month ago, I want to say. So you can go back through the archives, listen to that, if you want to hear more about the cases for ABC privatisation. Cool. All right. So I've got one here. So this is from The Australian and our good friends at the CIS in Sydney, another really great free market think tank. They released a YouGov Galaxy poll. Well, they commissioned a YouGov Galaxy poll around The Australian. And I'll show you some stats here. It's revealed that 58% of millennials, so us around this podcast, those born between 1980 and 1996 viewed socialism favorably, 58%.
Ouch.
Yeah. Support was even higher among university graduates at 63%. Oh. So something about universities is making people more socialist. Yeah. So might want to investigate what's going on there. 59% were of the view that capitalism had failed society, and 62% believed that Australian workers were worse off now than they were 40 years ago, notwithstanding the economic data suggesting otherwise. Then we get into the crazy stuff. And I do like a good crazy stuff section. So of the 1,003 people polled, only 21% were familiar with the Chinese Communist Revolutionary Mao Zedong, 26% were familiar with Vladimir Lenin, and 34% knew about Soviet leader Joseph Stalin. So they're very socialist, but they haven't heard about the three biggest socialists of the 20th century.
Well, and I'll Google...
The three most murderous,
true.
If I may.
I will Google all those guys once this conversation finishes. But yeah, look, very, very... not surprising... Not surprising, but we shouldn't get too despondent because as we commissioned our survey a couple of years ago where we found that young people, two-thirds of them wanted to start their own business. And as you mentioned the last time we did this podcast...
I was about to mention it again, but yeah. Now the sort of allure of spontaneity is gone.
Why don't you just do it then?
Well, Pete, I don't know if you remember this, but... I don't remember this, but yeah, so we're talking about that. IPA... That was a really cool poll. You can look at that on our website. And then Reason, Free Market Foundation in the US, had a poll where they were showing how young people were more favorable of more government services and, you know, socialism and high government spending. Mm. They're more favorable of that than less government services. But the second that they weren't, like, so, okay, well, would you like these more services if it meant you paid higher tax, or would you want less services if it meant lower tax? Then it flips into lower tax. So once people start thinking with their hip pockets, socialism loses its allure, which is basically the teaching for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah, and there's also amongst young people in a lot of these surveys a general distrust of government, which I think is healthy. I just think socialism is kind of cool at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, if you wanted to be cool at uni, you really want to be a socialist.
Well, I was.
A socialist or socialized?
Pete was a socialist at uni, is that what you said?
Yeah, not like an official socialist, I was just a lefty. I was a lefty. I wasn't like a socialist, but I wasn't cool.
All right, I need to investigate this further.
We've literally talked about this thousands of times. Anyway.
I never listen to you when you speak. I'm just waiting for my turn.
Well, I have one more thing about this. Anyway, oh yeah, and the other thing is young people aren't young people forever.
Yes.
So those people can change their
views. Yeah, there is a time. There are other constraints of time.
Yeah, there's time. The fourth dimension, if you will. So anyway.
We will master that dimension one day, Pete.
Yeah.
Cool, so we'll move on. I also want to talk about Lionel Shriver.
Oh, okay. I thought...
Okay. Oh, we can talk about something else.
I thought I was doing Lionel Shriver.
Yeah, so I would like you to talk about Lionel Shriver.
Sorry.
Seamless.
Given we've already done this show.
Are we sure that the last...
I don't do this Friday night, people.
Are we sure the last chip doesn't work?
I have no idea. For clarification, it wasn't my fault.
It wasn't anyone's fault.
It's no one's fault.
It was the machine.
Nino, I think it was Pete's fault.
Lionel Shriver.
Don't tell him.
You'll remember Lionel Shriver because she was on the Brisbane Writers' Festival where Yasmin Abdel-Magid shot to prominence because Lionel Shriver said that cultural appropriation was stupid, which Yasmin made a brave stand and walked out. Now, Lionel Shriver is the author of... What is it again?
We need to talk about
Kevin. Which is a bloody good book. I was scared when I read it. But do yourself a favour. Anyway, she had a piece in the UK Specky a couple of weeks ago, where she sort of said that it was bad that this publishing house that she kind of got wind of had all these massive diversity rules around who they hire, et cetera, et cetera, which is fine because they're a private company, but she was making fun of it, and it was a very excellent and funny piece. Within that piece, actually, she mentioned that London has a walking and cycling commissioner, which is funny. I didn't know that. His name is Will Norman, and Will Norman bemoaned the fact that cycling was too male, middle class, and white. Now, Will, I'm not sure if you're familiar with hipsters.
Yeah, but I think there's a deeper problem there than cycling.
That's the way it goes. And he said the real challenge for London cycling is diversity. So that was pretty funny. Anyway,
what is the 9 to 5 of the cycling commissioner, by the way? Well, apart from complaining about white people.
I think we're getting to why. Interesting himself in this kind of stuff. Anyway, for her piece in the Speccy about diversity quotas, she got booted from a panel judging an award at the UK Women's Fiction Awards for her troubles. That's the story.
Mm. Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, I mean, she's right. You've got all these publishing houses that are diversity above all else, especially above story, above the characters, etc. And they are going to start dying out, these publishers, because if they don't sell books, they can't keep in business, no matter how diverse they are.
So they're putting, obviously, diversity before quality.
Yeah. And I'm not saying, diverse authors can't write good books, but I'm saying, the primary focus should be, is it a good book?
Exactly right. And, go on. Yeah. Douglas Murray had a piece in the Speccy, which I came across when I was reading this one, where he explained how the schools in the United States, the colleges in the United States that have pursued these diversity policies the most and had big controversies, have experienced really big falls in their enrollments, which is pleasing, which is why I'm not so upset about the CIS study. It's making me optimistic.
Yes.
The market will win.
Good. I like optimistic Pete.
Yeah, well, every now and then.
Pessimistic Pete is funny, but optimistic Pete is just, better to be around, I guess.
Well, thank you. Wilfrid Laurier in Canada, Lindsay Shepherd's University, for example, is experiencing a big fall in enrollments, probably because of that incident. Evergreen College as well, with the Weinstein thing, et cetera, et cetera.
I think you also wanted to bring up the Monty Python thing.
Yes.
Or are we leaving that for second part of the show?
At the end.
Okay, so you've changed your mind from the last time we recorded this.
Yep.
Okay, seamless.
Wow.
We should record every podcast twice. I don't know why we don't do it.
I know.
Cool. All right, last story we're going to talk about at the start here. So the Southern Poverty Law Centre, people might know them as a bunch of nincompoops, and especially over the last 10 years or so. They used to be this really cool place that invented individual liberty. They took on cases. They've now...
They were huge in the civil rights movement.
Huge in the civil rights movement.
Like sort of from the early 70s.
But now the absolute shell of what they used to be. They are very big on publishing the names of people they consider hate preachers and stuff like that, or hate mongers. And people might know them as the place that keeps on calling Ayaan Hirsi Ali an anti-Muslim extremist.
Which is just incredible.
Which is... if anyone has the ability to commentate on matters of the Islamic faith, I think Ayaan Hirsi Ali would be one of them. Anyway, so Southern Poverty Law Center, they're on the back foot now. So they also went after another one, Majid Nawaz. Now, if you guys don't know who he is, really cool guy. You should definitely YouTube him. He's from Britain. He used to be a member of Al-Qaeda, or like an Al-Qaeda linked group, was a terrorist. Saw the error of the ways, got out, and is now teaching.
Wasn't people. An actual terrorist.
No, but was involved with organizations were extremist. Got out, realized the error of the ways, and is now working to de-radicalize young people who might be at risk. And Southern Poverty Law Center had labeled him, I think the quote is here, an anti-Muslim extremist. He sued them. It's an interesting free speech case because on the one hand, if there were people that he's talking to who might be at risk of radicalizing and they Google who he is and they see that he's anti-Muslim extremist, it's probably going to push those at-risk people away from him. So, you do need to get on the front foot with that stuff. But, when defamation lawsuits get brought up, it is a bit of a chilling of free speech. The IPA's position has always been the answer to bad speech is more speech, less speech. So, Pete, what did you reckon of it?
Well, absolutely. So, I take the free speech point about it. 3.375 million US would mind a slice of that coin. If
he wants to throw it
Southern
over.
Southern Poverty Law Center.
Yeah, we're also against extremism, so,
Hit me.
Yeah.
So, what was I going to say?
The only extremism we like is cash payouts.
the freedom of speech issue, which I have a problem with, but putting that to one side, the reason why the Southern Poverty Law Center is important is because organizations like Google and Amazon take their word on diversity and take their word on hate speech and stuff like that, and they use them as their hate group assessments, which is, they're big, important companies, and it's a problem that they take information from this organization, which has a crazy warped view of what actual hate is.
Yeah, absolutely. And then we also, this is coming out this morning, so the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, you know, absolute giants of the free speech game. Yeah. American Civil Liberties Union, absolute giants. And a internal memo got leaked out to, I think, Reason, talking about how they're now going to start weighing up other issues such as social justice, racial equality, and women's rights when they decide whether or not they're going to take on free speech cases. Mm. I think the memo said, our defense of speech may have a greater or lesser harmful impact on the equality of justice work to which we are also committed, wrote ACLU staffers in a confidential memo obtained by former board member Wendy Cabota. Mm. So, ACLU, if you guys don't know, like a while back, I think 10, 20 years ago.
In the 70s, I reckon.
In the 70s? Mm-hmm. 70s getting a lot of shout outs in the early part of this podcast. Mm. A lot of stuff happened back in the 70s.
Good era.
So, back in the 70s, this neo-Nazi group wanted to have a march, and they wanted to march through a suburb that had a very high Jewish population, and especially a very high population of people that survived the Holocaust. And it was a huge free speech issue at the time. In America. And the ACLU came out in support of the neo-Nazis. They said it's a peaceful march. They should be allowed to march where they are. You know, if people start throwing bricks and stuff like that, then that's a different issue altogether. But for the marching itself, that should be allowed. And the interesting part is that, like, the ACLU was run by a Jewish person at the time. So you had a Jewish person say this neo-Nazi group should be allowed to march through a Jewish suburb. That's as hardcore free speech as you can get.
That's super hardcore.
That is super, super hardcore. So it's interesting to see this really hardcore free speech group sort of just become a shell of itself and start to falter in their commitment to freedom of speech.
Yeah, it is. It is a shame. And it's not like there's no other organizations in America that are focusing on the issues they are now weighing up.
Yeah.
There's obviously millions.
Yeah.
But there's not many hardcore free speech organisations.
But there is one in Australia, Pete.
Oh,
which, because we're at the end of the opener here, we can probably start plugging IPA membership, Nina.
Yes. So if you like what our work and you like to become a part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button to become a member, starting as low as $22. But yeah.
Really end. All right, so this podcast, it's available on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, and through our Hey What Did I Miss email. Make sure you guys are subscribed. Our listener numbers have been really going up the last few weeks. It's been great to see, so make sure you keep telling people about it. If you are subscribed on iTunes, make sure you rate and review the podcast. You can leave a 5-star review. That really helps us with the rankings, makes me feel good inside. And you can also leave a comment, maybe a tip for the show, Pete and I. That's all I got.
Thanks for all your support.
That's a good one. Let's go to Dr. Peter Hendy and Simon Breeny. Okay, we are now joined by Dr. Peter Hendy, former Liberal Party MP and author of the new book, Why Australia Slept, which is out now with Connercourt Publishing. You can buy it on their website. So just to give our listeners a bit of a background, so Dr. Hendy was a former chief economist in the office of the Australian Prime Minister, also the Assistant Minister for Finance, Assistant Cabinet Secretary, and Assistant Minister for Productivity in the Australian Government. So big fish we're talking to right now. Now, so your new book, Why Australia Slept, the central premise is that Australia is sleepwalking into its future without dealing with critical economic and political reform issues. So why do you see Australia sleepwalking into the future?
Well, thanks for having me on. There's obviously a number of challenges facing Australia. There's always challenges facing a country in terms of the economy or international relations. And I am actually concerned that Australia may repeat its past, its history. For the best part of 8 decades, from 1901 to the 1980s in particular, we had a policy framework where we had high protection, very heavily regulated industries, centralised wage fixing, and nominally that looked okay for Australia for many years because we had abundant resources and we were blessed with them, and that's why the title of the book is Why Australia Slept, because we were relying on these things, but in fact the economic and international framework in which we were working wasn't actually to the benefit of the country. by the 1970s, Australia was starting to go back in relative terms in living standards compared to the OECD countries. And basically the business community, which had been important in actually putting together that actually heavily regulated industry, and I can explain that later why they actually supported that at the time, they were mugged by reality. And the business community understood through the late 70s, early 80s that there was really big problems that need to be addressed. And they argued for change. And we introduced, and it depends on what terminology you want to use, a pro-market economic framework, a neoliberal set of economic policies. It's up to you which brand name you want to use. But the fact is we introduced them. We got things into place that were improving the economy, and everything was starting to hum along towards the end of the 1990s and into the 2000s. And basically, we hit a brick wall in 2007. There's no coincidence that there was a change of government away from the Howard government to the Rudd government at that time. And unfortunately, I think that we are in severe danger of, as I say, sleepwalking into the future. We are nominally doing well. Recent economic data for Australia has been good. There were national accounts out recently that showed the Australian economy was running at 3%. But the fact is that it is very fragile, and especially in an international climate where I actually think the Chinese economy, for example, is also very fragile. And our significant reliance on China is a danger signal for Australia. Never since we were a colony and so dependent on the British for our trading situation have we been so dependent on an overseas country for our economic survival. And so there are a whole lot of challenges, and we need to return to the pro-market policies and keep implementing them.
Righto, Peter, let's talk about some of these policies that are going to reinvigorate Australia's economy. One of the ones you mentioned, which is really important to the supported by the IPA, is returning income taxing powers back to the states. Why don't you talk us through that and explain what benefits that would have for us?
So one of the very dysfunctional aspects of the Australian nation is how we undertake Commonwealth-state financial relations. I'm a strong supporter of the Federation and the fact that we have states and we have a division of power across the country. I think that's very important that we have a number of state governments. Some people would argue that in itself is dysfunctional. I'm not one of those people. I think you have to have different centres of power, especially in such a very, very large geographically large land mass as Australia is. So our federal financial structure is badly broken. And there is, to summarise it, there's some perverse incentives and signals in our financial system that don't necessarily encourage state governments to do well. There's a significant lot of cross subsidy, as we know, across the states. But I'm not going to go into that right now. One of the issues is that the state governments, who are responsible for a large amount of public spending in this country, such as on hospitals and schools, police forces, most of the railroad infrastructure, ports, they don't raise enough money. And when they go to the federal government to get that money, then there becomes this dysfunction between who raises the money and gets the opprobrium for raising the money, and those who spend it and get the plaudits for spending the money. And there is a dysfunction there. And so one of the proposals that... Now, I didn't invent this idea. It's been around for many years, but I think it's a good idea, and I think it can be implemented, is to return some of the income taxing powers back to the states so that they have a growth tax that helps them raise the money for what they want to spend in a country, in their jurisdiction.
Yeah, so tax reform for federalism is, as Pete said, it's an issue that the IPA cares deeply about. So if we have listeners out there who do want to read more about this, so Dr. Hendy himself actually wrote an article for the IPA Review a few years ago talking about this issue. That's available on our website. And you can also read a recent report by the IPA's Morgan Begg, which got talked to the Senate Estimates Committee afterwards, talking about how we need to reform GST. So that's all on our website. So, Dr. Hendy, you say in your book that 2016 was such a near loss for the coalition because voters, and I'm quoting here, they wanted to see a major reform to deal with Australia's economic challenges, and they just weren't getting that from the coalition. In light of that, election coming up pretty soon, coalition are looking in all sorts of trouble. What areas, aside from maybe GST, what other areas could the coalition be looking at as a place that needs a lot of reform right now, a place that the voters want a lot of reform right now? What are the areas they should be really looking at?
Well, the public, I think going back to that comment I made about 2016, is that I think the public, although when you break down a lot of these economic policies or whatever, and you can say, well, that's not popular and that's not popular, you can put them all together and they can be popular because the people think you're doing something that is advancing the country. And John Howard became a past master at this when he was Prime Minister and was able to implement a lot of good reform. And quite recently, we don't have to go back too many years, we saw quite a significant privatisation and infrastructure package put forward by Mike Baird, who was Premier of New South Wales and went to an election, won it comfortably, and then implemented those changes. And I think Mike Baird won a lot of plaudits for that. Now, will that be able to be done by this federal government before the next election? I don't know. I think there is something I do say in the book there's another part to the story. And this is that when you look at the challenges facing Australia, one of the things that is an important theme in the book that I've got and is being addressed but is very important is actually getting the budget back in order. Because one of the things that, if you go back to the lesson of the Howard / Peter Costello era, is that the first thing they did was get the budget back in order so that they had a strong budget position so that they could implement a lot of reform. And if implementing reform required a bit of dough spent here or a bit of dough spent there, they actually had the dough without going into debt. And the present federal government came into office with a major debt legacy from the previous government, Rudd government. And they've been trying mightily to try and fix that. That gets to the question about the Senate, and I don't know if you'll ask me about that and parliamentary reform, but that is another part to this equation, and I talk about it in the book. But the main thing that was in the recent federal budget and a centrepiece was getting the budget back into surplus next year. I think that is actually the number one priority.
Absolutely. So you found a lot of really cool areas that we could be looking at for a reform package. But as you said at the start there, it's very hard for governments and opposition parties to sell these reform packages to the Australian people. What do you see this complacency in the Australian people where they sort of, they turn away from reform packages, they're not interested? Where does that complacency come from to you? Is it possible that Australia's just had it so good for so long that we don't feel we need reform?
Well, I think there's a complex answer to that. But put as simply as possible, I wouldn't say it's in the character necessarily that we're complacent and lazy, which some people do say.
Me neither. I agree.
If you go overseas, if an Australian goes as and this is a young audience, I understand that we're talking to. If soon after uni or whatever, or you're in your 20s and you go overseas to work, It's quite easy for Aussies to get jobs overseas because Australians overseas are regarded as very hardworking and smart people. But it's the first bit that sometimes shocks people back home, that our work ethic is actually quite good. Now, to answer your question more specifically, the thing is that I think that we have a dysfunctional democracy in terms of parliament, and I do think there is a problem with respect to the Senate and how we have large crossbenches, and they are stopping governments of either Liberal or Labor Party implementing their mandates. And when decade after decade, election after election, the Australian public elect a political party to become the government, and then because of the Senate, they are incapable of getting their mandate implemented. No wonder many Australians are very jaundiced about Australian democracy, and that is a very concerning issue for the nation as a whole into the future. I have raised in the book also about social media. I think it can be very toxic. My view is that it can be, it sort of in some ways can lean against a reformist agenda, because it can, within 12 hours, 36 hours, 48 hours, kill off an idea that 2 decades ago would have, been debated in the public arena for several months before, people decided on it. Nowadays, politicians who react to the media can have something that they may raise an idea at 12 o'clock in the afternoon and it's dead by 7 o'clock because of a violent reaction on social media. Now, to a large extent, that's politicians at fault because they are reacting to something that in many cases is ephemeral, but they do react to it and it's something that we have to be alive to.
Brilliant. So, Dr. Peter Handy, the book is Why Australia Slept. That's available from Connor Court Publishing. You can go to the website, connorcourtpublishing.com.au, if you want to buy a copy. Dr. Handy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, we now welcome once again one of our favourites, IPA Policy Director Simon Bruni. Welcome back to the show.
You can say I am the favourite.
Well, we don't like lying, so...
Yeah, you're in the top few.
Top 10. That's top 10 staff members that we have on regularly.
Okay. We interviewed Michael Bogart.
I can't get a word.
Michael Bogart?
Andrew Bogart. That's still my favourite.
There's just no way for me to... Okay, all right. I've got some clear air, finally.
Okay. All right, cool. Well, let's get into it. So, ABC privatisation, the big story of the week. What did you make of it? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I thought it was really cool that this was all kicked off because of a couple of academics at RMIT... friends, no doubt, friends of the podcast. I wouldn't say that they're your favourite, but, second and third maybe.
Big top three for sure.
So that's Professor Sinclair Davidson and Dr. Chris Berg, who are adjunct fellows here at the IPA, but their full-time roles are actually at RMIT, even though the IPA is getting the blame for the book and getting the blame for kicking this debate off, which is kind of nice.
The credit.
Says something. Yeah, that's right, exactly.
IPA drives more clicks than RMIT. That's why they're doing it.
Yeah, of course. I mean, it's also a branding exercise too. A lot of people know that we've been in favour of privatising the ABC for a long time. And so, of course, when a book comes out highlighting why the ABC might want to be privatised, we get the credit, as you say. But, I mean, I think the other thing that was really important, of course, to all of this is that the Young Liberal Movement passed a motion or put forward a motion that was then passed at the Liberal Party's Federal Council last weekend. And that then kicked off a discussion about whether the government would go down the path of privatising the ABC, which we would all love for them to do, but they unfortunately hosed that down, poured cold water all over that 5 minutes after the debate.
But the young stars coming through.
Yeah, exactly right. And I think it's terrific that people like Mitch Collier, who moved the debate, the vice president of the Young Liberal Movement, was able to articulate in such a clear way why the ABC should be privatised and why the media landscape looks completely different in 2018 to what it did in the 1930s, and why that might mean that the ABC is not the kind of government program that we might think is appropriate.
I have been following this from sort of not afar, but outside the actual debate. Would it be fair to say that suggesting the ABC should be privatised has made a lot of people go absolutely apeshit?
Yeah, that's probably...
Are we a swearing podcast now? Huge. We swear. Right, I got a few words I want to get off my chest.
That's
Balderdash.
That's probably I was watching 30 Rock last night, and there's a character on there who calls someone who says someone, "You're being a real C-word," and then he says, "Yeah, that's right, a real cranky Sue."
Yeah, well, lots of cranky Sues out there up in arms about this.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things I've found fascinating is that almost every one of the defences, the arguments in defence of the ABC, has been terrible. I haven't read one that I've found in the slightest convincing. Partly because I think none of it is actually addressing any of the issues that have been raised by Berg and Davidson. And I just think if you're not going to address the criticisms that have been made, then does that mean that they're valid?
Yeah, I want to point out one in particular. So Gideon Roslin was on Sky News on the weekend with Ben Oakquist, and Ben would say something like, "Oh, we still need regional broadcasting." And it's, to me, it's just so annoying because like any inner city lefty ever cares about regional broadcasting any other time than ABC privatisation debates.
That's true.
Like, at what point has, like, I don't want to single out Ben Oakquist, but at what point has that the people with that argument ever thought, what of the people of Dubbo? Yeah. What are they going
to
do?
And the people in Dubbo want to watch Tonightly with Tom Ballard as
well. Yeah, they huddle around, you know, let's go to the pub, let's watch Tonightly.
Yeah, they care deeply about these people, particularly the people in the Galilee Basin who are crying out for the Adani mine to be built so that they can actually go to work every day.
Yeah, so they're not sitting around listening regional radio.
You're right. I mean, it's just, it is so hypocritical, and it's, I mean, again, I think it's just an example of the hypocrisy, I guess, of a lot of those people, because they don't really care about it. And I mean, and a lot of, very few of them, I think, actually grew up in a regional area, and I did grow up in a regional area, and the media landscape's actually pretty rich. It's pretty diverse. There's a lot of people who are doing their own thing like they do in the city, but there's also a lot of major networks too. You know, I grew up watching the regional affiliates of a lot of the main channels that we watch here in metropolitan Melbourne and Sydney, and they do a great job. The IPA is on Wynn News in Bendigo a lot of the time, and that's what I used to watch when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm. And you can privatise everything except the bush radio stations. Let's do that. That's a starting point.
Yeah, I mean, this is the other thing that I don't quite understand. I mean, what proportion of the ABC's budget is dedicated to regional and rural broadcasting? It's tiny, right? I mean, most of it is either South Bank here in Melbourne or it's Ultimo in Sydney. Most of their program is coming out of that, and most of the costs associated with the ABC and the $1 billion a year that the taxpayer shovels into the ABC is metropolitan base.
Okay, cool. I want to throw you another question that we usually get from the left about ABC privatisation, and I feel Simon's a good person to answer this one. Simon, how do you justify wanting the ABC privatised if you yourself go on the ABC a lot?
Yes, Simon.
Yeah, what's up with that?
I've never quite understood this, particularly if the argument is that the ABC shouldn't be biased. It's like, yeah, we shouldn't be biased, but there's a particular view that we can't ever hear on the ABC, and that's that the ABC shouldn't exist.
Yeah, we should celebrate all diversities except viewpoint.
Yeah. That's a really good question, James, and I prefer to be called
a Twitter egg.
Yeah, that's right, a fake Twitter account. I'm a regular on the ABC, it's fair to say. In fact, this week I was on the ABC talking about why the ABC should be privatised, and I think Chris Berg probably did about 3 or 4 interviews on the ABC talking.
Yeah, you were telling us, like, you went to the ABC to talk about how it should be privatised, and then the person previous to you in the guest sign-in was Chris Berg.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So at the same time that I was on 774 in Melbourne, he was on the Sydney radio talking about privatisation. So I just think it's a red herring, really. I mean, it says nothing about whether or not the ABC should be privatised. And at the end of the day, because the ABC is owned by all of us as Australians and as Australian taxpayers, they need to have viewpoint diversity. They need to make sure that they're as broad as possible, because not only is their audience diverse, but I think the viewpoints they have on radio and on TV should be diverse as well.
All right, absolutely. Let's move on to another topic, which is really interesting. So Coles and Woolworths are now, they're not giving plastic bags for free. If you want a plastic bag,
so annoying.
Yeah. If you want a plastic bag, you want an extra 15 cents. Now, annoying, all right? No one wants to be spending 15 cents on plastic bags. There's absolutely no way I'm ever going to remember to bring a reusable bag into work, because I do my shopping after work. But it's a kind of an interesting question in that, like, what's the free market position on this? Because obviously supermarkets can do whatever the hell they want.
Yeah, they can. There's a few things to say about this. One, they're responding to what they think is going to be a future regulatory environment. So it's not actually necessarily a completely free market that we're looking at here. And they, what they think that they're doing is they're getting out in ahead of regulation that they think state governments are going to be responsible for. And by doing that, they think that they're going to be head off a regulatory environment that might be worse for them. So that's one thing. The second thing is because of the red tape that exists around running a business in Australia, there may be more supermarkets in a free market environment than the Coles and Woolies duopoly that we've essentially got now. Metcash is there, and there are some other smaller supermarkets around, but basically, you know, Coles and Woolies dominate the market, and who knows what kind of competitive forces might be there if that red tape and those taxes didn't exist in Australia. And the other thing is, yeah, okay, they're free to do what they like, but I also think it's a bad idea, and if they do things that I think are bad, I'll call them out for it. And I think that charging people for plastic bags, while they're free to do it, and you know, there's not necessarily at the moment a government law or regulation that's forcing them to do it, I just think it's a bad idea.
Wasn't it Gideon Rosner? Well, it was Gideon Rosner who was on all the radio stations in the world yesterday, who said, "Call me a cynic," which I would never call Gideon, but this is about profit.
Yeah, exactly right. So the point that he's making is if you look at the balance sheets of the big supermarkets, a really, really significant amount of their profit can be attributed to sales of plastic bags. Because if you're giving away millions and millions of these things for free, mm-hmm. and you're now selling those things, guess what?
Yeah.
Call me a cynic.
Yeah. So you don't see it's a complete coincidence that supermarkets have really embraced this environmental message on the same issue that can also get them a whole lot of money.
Exactly right.
It's
exactly
weird
right.
that they're being so altruistic, yet also so benefiting.
Exactly. So I just think the experiment I'd love to see run is for one supermarket to go down this path of the virtue signalling, you know, let's charge people for plastic bags. But I'd love for the other supermarket to make the decision to say, all right, well, we actually want to differentiate ourselves and we're going to go completely the other way. We're going to give our plastic bags away for free. We're
plastic
not going to get involved.
Everyone.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to double bag everything.
Yeah.
They wouldn't do that because that's inefficient. But
never drop an egg again.
That's right. And I'd love to see them go down those two separate paths and to see what happened over 5 or 10 years.
Yeah, you wrote that in Slack this morning. I was going to find the clip of that Simpsons episode where everything in this supermarket turns into Starbucks in like a 15-second stretch. But then it's like, well, that's not the reference anymore. Like Starbucks have completely gone the other way.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So we'll move on to another one. So a bit of personal stuff. So you were in Ireland recently.
I was,
Still haven't talked to you about why or what it was like. So this is a bit of a discovery for me as well. So what was it like?
There you go. So I flew over to Dublin, spent a night in Dublin and then headed over to Galway. And the reason I was in Ireland is because my family is from Ireland and there were about 120 Brehonies from all around the world, from
good
Europe,
God.
Australia, the US. And we're all gathering to celebrate all things Breheny. So that's what it was about.
All global, two things Breheny.
All global family reunion.
So we've been pronouncing your name incorrectly.
Yeah, it's actually Simon Breheny. Yeah, and I'm now enforcing that.
In media and everything.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, cool. Yeah. So
Breheny.
I'll be telling producers something that they're going to be very surprised about.
Yeah, because it's not like everyone was getting your name right already. There's an extra curveball in there. They've just got to Breheny from like Breheny, and now we're getting Breheny.
So we learned a few really cool things. So I sort of knew about this already, but I learned a little bit more about the history of the Brehenys and their involvement in brewing. Mm-hmm. So our family once brewed what is now 4X. Beer. So to all of our Queensland listeners, you'll be very proud to know that the Breheny name is associated with the beer that you love to drink every Friday night and maybe a bit throughout the rest of the week too. And the other thing that we learnt too, and I didn't know this, was that, you know, that famous image of the construction workers sitting on that steel girder above the Empire State Building in New York City? So the guy who sits fourth to the left, from the left, is a guy called Michael Breheny, and he is the father of one of the guys that attended the reunion over in Galway in Ireland.
There you go.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool.
That is very cool, Simon. Did you learn much about leprechaun economics in Ireland?
No.
Oh, really?
No. Yeah. I mean, yes.
You already knew?
No.
Oh, okay. So Ireland had massive tax cuts in the 90s and now they're flourishing economically.
Oh, yes, they are. Yeah, that's true.
I didn't know that. They used to be like the poorest country in Europe, but now they're going well.
Yeah, now they're
going better.
Yeah, they're going a lot better. Yeah, yeah.
That's it. That's all
they've got a great corporate tax environment. So yeah. That's probably something that Australia could learn a lot from.
And you sort of, you don't think, you wouldn't expect that about Ireland, but it's true.
Yeah. Well, they need the really interesting thing about Ireland is they need something. So one of the things is you drive through Ireland, or I took the train from Dublin to Galway, and there are just stone fences everywhere. And people think the reason there are those stone fences around everywhere is because they look cool, or you know, because they didn't have wood or something like that. But the reason why is because to get agriculture going, they had to clear fields of these of all these stones, all these rocks. And they had to move them, and they had to put them somewhere. So they started building these stone walls everywhere. And the reason why they've done that is so that they could get to the soil and actually grow things. So it's actually a really difficult place to get agriculture off the ground. There's not a huge amount of resources. So they've got to do something to get their economy going. And what they've done is they've tried to attract as much investment as they can through a low corporate tax rate.
There you go.
Cool. All right. Let's move on to last topic that we've got here. So the US this week withdrew from the UN Human Rights Council.
Yeah.
That was pretty interesting thing, and didn't get a whole lot of play that I thought it was going to get, but what did you reckon of that decision?
Yeah, well, there's a lot happening at the moment in US politics and the decisions that Trump is making, so this kind of...
Yeah, there's only so much outrage that can be had at the same time.
It's finite. It's a finite amount.
So this sort of moved down the rankings a bit, I think, in terms of the fake news media, but I thought it was really...
The lamestream media, we call it in this podcast.
I thought it was really cool, though, because good on Nikki Haley and President Trump and the administration for standing up to this sham organization. It's not in favor of human rights. The kind of countries that sit as members of the Human Rights Council are some of the most abhorrent regimes in the world when it comes to human rights abuses. And the fact that they sit in judgment of liberal democracies like the United States and Australia, I just think...
And Israel.
Israel.
Exactly. Let's face it. I mean, like almost half of the resolutions that ever come out of the United Nations Human Rights Council in relation to Israel, and the fact that they condemn Israel and not all of the countries that sit around it that continually abuse human rights when Israel is the only liberal democracy in the region.
You nearly said another swear word there. I did. That was very close. Might have had to have bleeped that one.
That's just mind-bendingly stupid. It's so obvious that this organisation is corrupted. Because of the members that sit on it, and because they're self-interested and they don't in fact assess things on their merits. So I think, you know, it seems like a pretty straightforward decision, but it's a big deal because the United States is a big player in the United Nations.
Yeah, is it just me or is Nikki Haley like the one person from this Trump administration who can come out looking so much better than they did before, so untouched, like... definite future presidential candidate?
I certainly wouldn't be surprised if at some point she puts her hand up for it, and so she should. I think she's done a terrific job, and frankly, can you imagine what it would be like doing the job that she does at the United Nations?
Yeah, you'd cop a lot.
Going into that absolute swamp and having to advocate for the things that she does. And it's not just advocating on behalf of Trump. My sense is that she really does believe everything that she's doing, and that's why she does such a good job.
Absolutely.
What, when you say everything she's doing, what other stuff have the United States done?
They're pushing back on a whole range of things. This is just the latest, but she's been a really significant advocate for Israel, not only around the human rights, what's happening on the Human Rights Committee, but also more generally as well. So I think that the work that she's doing on that front is terrific. This is the most substantive thing that they've done so far. When it comes to the UN, her work is difficult, because can you imagine the kind of people that go to the UN? They're the people who probably love the UN the most out of all of these countries, and they're the ones that she's got to deal with every day. So.
Yeah, she'd cop a lot of brave stands against her. Yeah, a lot of very brave, noble stands.
That's right, exactly. It's a bit like, I imagine, the work of Nigel Farage or Dan Hannan going to the EU Parliament.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's hundreds and hundreds of MEPs around you who all think that you're an idiot, and I think that'd be a tough environment, but if you thrive on it, like I think... certainly Farage does in the EU, and like Nikki Haley looks like she's doing in the UN, then you can really make a name for yourself.
Yeah, I can't imagine what it'd be like surrounded by people who secretly think you're an idiot, or I wonder what that would be like. Anyway, cool. Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, thank you to Dr. Peter Handy and Simon Breeny for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. So let's get into some stories from around the world that made us laugh. We'll start with this. This has been... What's up with this?
Yeah, this sounds great.
Yeah, so this has been something we've been talking about the podcast for a while. Every week, I expect it to be the last time we discuss it, and only for a few days later to be revealed that it's not. I genuinely think we're going to be discussing this until every week until the end of time.
This is,
straw man arguments.
We're ahead of the curve.
It's not going away. It's not. It's getting stronger.
We normally like distill news. This is us making news.
Yes.
I mean, it's obviously not, but...
Mayor of Scoop City.
Yeah. Just call me Scoop. Well, Scoop McKenzie. Or Nina Scoop, really.
Scoop McKenzie.
This is Nina's favourite topic.
All right, cool. So, for new listeners of the show, welcome. But also, a while back, a 9-year-old kid in Los Angeles did a school project. He called 3 different straw manufacturers. He said, how many straws do you guys sell a year? He upscaled that to determine that the US goes through 1.1 straw per person per day, equivalent to like...
It's 500 million,
500 million straws every year. It's bogus. It's like...
No, every day.
Every day.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I feel like we cane this kid a lot. 500 million in it. It's like 170 million or something.
Yeah.
He's not so far off.
It's pretty... It's nearly three times higher.
Yeah.
And look, it's a 9-year-old kid.
Yeah.
All right?
Doing a school project.
9-year-old's fine by me. It is the governments that have taken on this with nary a thought. That is what...
Nary.
Nary a thought.
You're all happy with that? Okay, sorry. If you're happy with that, I'm happy with that.
I'm going.
Okay.
Nary a thought have pushed through with this. Stores are now banned. Like, single-use plastic stores are now banned in, I think, Los Angeles and New York. I think it's about to go out to London and Toronto. Last week we had Tom, and it's not governments now, it's going into celebrities. There's like a straw challenge on Instagram. You got to tag people that aren't going to use single plastic straws. Tom Brady made an Instagram post saying, I'm not going to fall for your ruse, straw. Still don't quite know how straws are capable of Machiavellian manipulation, but I'm not a 5-time Super Bowl MVP.
Just sells into him for his, because he makes her laugh.
Yes. Good. Good by you.
Could I just jump in quickly? So when you say ban, a lot of them haven't been banned. They're just sort of going to tax them and stuff like that.
Yeah, so
anti-straw measures.
Anti-straw measures.
We deal with facts here.
Yeah. And they deal with straw man arguments.
Yeah.
It's moved on. So here are the latest people to take up the plight against single-use plastic straws. British DJ Calvin Harris.
Mm.
I don't know him that well.
I've done a dance to...
I've heard his name.
You've heard the name. Peter's dance to...
I've rocked out to Calvin Harris every now and then over the journey.
What's your favourite track?
I don't know.
That's just whatever comes on.
Yeah,
it's all good.
Yeah, it's all good stuff.
The city of Portland. Surprised they went first on this.
Well,
due to some of the stuff we read out of Portland.
Hmm.
So, a bit late to the game, but welcome. And certainly not least, McDonald's. They're going to move to paper straws, I think it is.
Okay, yeah.
But they're going to move away from single-use plastic straws. And like we were discussing with Simon, it's so altruistic of McDonald's to cut costs.
They hand out
so many single-use plastic straws. What great environmentalists they are going to a cheaper option.
Are they going to a cheaper option? Paper or are they charging? Plastic. Are they charging for straws?
No, they're going to paper straws, I think. It's just a little easier for them.
But they would do that anyway.
Yeah, but like it's just like they're branding themselves like, oh, look how environmentalist we are, when they're just thinking with their hip pocket.
Well, as the great Gideon Rosner would say, call me a cynic. But Nina, you're Australia's foremost straw expert. What do you think about this?
This, you know what? First time I heard about this, I thought it's going to add within a week.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing you know, it's been like weeks.
Yep.
Yeah.
I don't get it. Why are people just so involved with this straw thing? Like...
It is a Gangnam style of politics.
I know. I mean, like...
It has just been so long that we've been talking about this.
Like...
It'll go forever.
Yeah. Well, doing stuff with this straw would not change anything. Like, I'm all good with environment. Like, that's why I recommend a bamboo straw.
Every single week.
Like,
well, how are we not getting money from Bamboo International?
I know.
Are we not?
Bamboo's is readily available.
We're shills for Big Bamboo.
No, Nina's a shill for Big Bamboo.
Yeah, it is.
And Nina won't cut us in. She's clearly on the take.
Yeah.
I'm clearly on the take. Yeah.
If we can't get money from Majid Nawaz, I want money from Nina.
I need money first. Endorse me, people. I'm happy to do that. I'm happy to do a bamboo straw ads, actually.
Just like suddenly through the podcast. Like, ooh. All right, cool. Let's move on, Pete.
Rightio. So I've done some academic research for this podcast by reading this study by Ryan Murphy. Ryan Murphy, of course, a massive fan of the podcast. Listening to this, no doubt. But this is a different Ryan Murphy.
Oh, right. Okay.
A different Ryan Murphy. Than that Ryan Huge. Murphy. Ryan Murphy at the Southern Methodist University released a paper recently called Psychopathy in the United States, published last week. Now, it found that Washington, D.C., and I'll read it out, the District of Columbia is measured to be far more psychopathic than any individual state in the country, a fact that can be readily explained either by its very high population density, okay, or, and he doesn't pull any punches here, Ryan, by the type of person who may be drawn to a literal seat of power.
Yep. I'm going to side with the latter.
I don't know why a high population density has anything to do with it.
Yeah, I would lead with high population density.
They probably have a high rates of stress. That's why they're becoming a psychopath.
Well, as I may surprise you, I didn't read the whole paper, so I don't know.
But you said.
You just quoted that.
Well, I did control F Washington. But there you go. That's a surprise to no
one. So when he goes like high population density, was it psychopaths per square kilometer? Like what are we looking at there?
Ratio maybe.
That's a weird way of thinking about it.
The science is settled, James.
The science is settled. The most amount of psychopaths are right near the swamp. So I really look forward to this paper being published in the upcoming edition of Dark Quarterly. So we'll move on to another one here. So I've done straw man arguments. All right. So I got a new segment for you guys.
Yeah,
so we've done straw man arguments. We haven't had Q&A clap for a while, but we'll bring that back.
Yeah. We're trying to bring in new segments. It's hard because we have to think of it.
Trying to keep the powder dry on Q&A clap. Cool. So this is a new segment. All right. Many of you will be familiar with the famous clip of a well-spoken Australian man getting arrested outside a Chinese restaurant, bemoaning the very society in which it created his arrest. Please, if you don't know what I'm talking about, please YouTube Democracy Manifest, which is also the name of this segment. I will play the key clip to you right now.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
So have a look at that. If you haven't seen it, definitely Google it.
And watch it at least seven times, because every time you'll find something new to find it funny. So it's basically, this segment is just going to be stuff that makes you realize how corrupt and empty this society really is.
Yeah, it's when you feel like actually it's already done.
Yeah.
It's too late.
We've gone too far.
Yeah. We're rotten to the core.
Yeah. So this week, Nassau County in New York State has banned sparklers. If you don't know what sparklers are from that, you may remember them as the fun candle from kids' birthday parties.
Mm-hmm.
You had your standard candle, then you had the one where you could light it at the top, and it was like this, you know, New Year's Eve countdown of this flame going closer and closer to the stem, and all these like sparks would fly off, and you kept thinking that the birthday cake was going to catch on fire because you're 7 years old and you don't quite know how pyrotechnics work. Or you're 24 and you still don't.
Yeah.
So
if you buy like 5 packets of them, you can make a sparkler bomb.
That might be why it's banned.
Why they're banned.
I think Pete would do well in Nassau County, New York, local council.
You can make a bomb.
stop saying
that. I mean, like not a real bomb.
We're not endorsing bombers.
Just make birthday parties fun.
Yeah.
Is all I'm saying.
Yeah, and July 4th is coming up, obviously.
Yes, so July 4th is going to stink.
Doesn't it? Yeah.
So, and kids' birthday parties are really on the back foot here. If sparklers are getting banned and single-use plastic straws are getting banned, like, there's nothing to drink Coke out of, and the birthday cakes are going to be flat. So, yeah. I mean,
as long as they're bouncing, I'm fine.
Yeah. Dark Zone. As long as there's Dark Zone involved, I'll be happy. Showing my youth there. You don't know what I'm talking about.
Oh, no, I've done Dark Zone.
Yeah.
The kids can't drink either. So that's another thing they can't do.
Yeah. Birthday parties are rough these days. So, the banning sparklers... Everything sucks, which is why...
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
All right, sweet. New segment.
New segment.
Done.
Sending new suggestions.
Yeah, sending new suggestions.
Am I up?
Yes.
Okay, so we're up to BBC.
Are we?
Up to Shall we BBC. Move on then?
Shane Ellen, head of comedy at the BBC.
I think you said it all there.
Yeah. I mean, look.
BBC,
everyone
discuss.
Knows I'm going to say something that is going to be... Could easily be in Democracy Manifest.
This whole show could be Democracy Manifest.
That's what it should be called.
Oh, my God. We should call our show Democracy Matters.
Okay, add it to the list. Waiting for My Turn to Speak is another good name
that
we've been tossing about. Okay, Shane Allen, head of comedy at the BBC, said Monty Python was too white for today's BBC. The quote from Shane, if we're going to assemble a team now, it's not going to be six Oxbridge white blokes. It's going to be a diverse range of people who reflect the modern world and have got something to say that's different and we haven't seen before. Now, people can hire whoever they want for their comedy shows, but the BBC is a public company, James.
Yeah, absolutely. And if we were living in a world where Monty Python weren't there and the guys who made Monty Python were there and the BBC were looking for a voice that they haven't heard before and a new perspective on things, I recommend Monty Python. It was quite revolutionary at the time. Mate, I'm not going to go through that. I went on this whole rant about Monty Python and the whole time I'm just like, I'm going to get so many annoying emails. So now I'm not going to do the rant.
Okay.
But suffice to say that, yeah, it's quite, like, it's the hollowing out of, like we were discussing with Lionel Shriver, it's the hollowing out of the idea that, you know, content is king and you should really try and be the best. It's like, you know, Monty Python, six greatest comedic minds of Britain produced in that sort of era, probably don't need him.
I don't understand how Shane Allen became head of comedy, because he sounds like the least funny bloke ever.
Yeah.
Like, if you read through the quotes of all this article, which is in the Times, it's just like, you know, we need perspectives from different place and time. It's like, oh, mate.
Yeah.
It's just a few gags. Yeah. It's comedy, mate.
Yeah. It might be the same person that wrote the Tom Ballard thing that we talked about last week.
So it's like, snarky.
How do we improve this show?
Oh,
play
more
in the racial space.
Yeah, let's get more racial.
Yeah, that'll be hilarious. All right, so I got another one here. So the Great Meme War, it's upon us. Long promised, long threatened, it's finally here. So the EU, the noted god, well, you know, EU and what was the guy?
Shane Allen.
EU and Shane Allen, two absolute comedic titans. EU have decided that they're going to start banning memes.
Yep.
So they've got this upcoming regulation. Internet platforms would be required to monitor uploads by their users for copyright infringement. It was approved by the European Parliament Committee on Legal Affairs on Wednesday. The bill, now going to move to the European Parliament, says its aim is to make it easier for rights holders to license and be remunerated for online distribution of their work. So, if there's an image and you upload it to the internet, if you do not have rights for it, not only are you culpable for it, but also the platform on which you upload it. So, if you uploaded a meme to Facebook...
Which always breaches copyright.
Absolutely. If you uploaded a meme to Facebook and you didn't personally take that photo, Facebook would have to pay the proprietor of the image.
Yep.
Which kills memes, because memes, you can't ever locate. Like, you reckon we're ever going to find the original of the...
The maker?
Which one?
Original maker. Is that what you're saying?
No, but like, you know that photo where it's like the boyfriend's got his hand on the girl and the girlfriend's like, what?
Yeah,
and
he's
actually looking at the...
Having another girl.
Yeah. And then you can put so many different formats onto that of people distracted by other causes. But we're never going to find the original, so that entire meme would be dead.
Well, James, not sure if serious EU. Look at Nina, I love that one.
Now I get that.
Isn't that meme like 6 years old anyway?
No, I get that.
Pete hasn't been on the internet in 6 years.
Oh,
we should point out this has gone to the EU Parliament, so it's not technically a rule yet. It's just been the Parliament Committee has put it through to the... So the next stage is the EU.
Yeah.
But and they never muck it up. Those guys will not muck it up.
They've seen a lot of regulations that they didn't enforce.
Oh, they are a bastion of... I mean, once again, how are these people in charge of...
Comedy? Yeah. Also, like, EU... They've lost Britain. They might lose Italy.
Wow.
They're thinking to themselves, how do we get back into people's hearts?
Yeah.
I know, let's take away memes.
It's not a good move for them.
Not a good move.
All right.
Do you have any more?
No, that's all I got, man.
Okay, that was going to go... Oh, all right, a question without notice for you.
Have more.
Oh, you do have more? Which one do you have?
We're going to do the soccer.
This is a debacle.
This is
Where's the chip?
Are we doing the soccer what thing?
Yeah, so I was going to ask you. Oh, okay. So, SBS Optus. So... this is being played out all over the media. So SBS, and this has really angered John, our executive director here. So SBS had the rights to the World Cup, sold them off to Optus. Why do we have the SBS at that point when we're talking about ABC privatization? So sell it off to Optus. Optus run a very bad service.
Yes.
They forgot that people like to watch the World Cup.
Yeah,
they didn't anticipate that people might want to see it.
I was surprised by the demand.
And they've now given it back to SBS. and then the whole country could watch on free-to-air as Australia was robbed of the VAR. So, Pete, three questions at the same time. One, yeah, why do we have the SBS? Two, Optus, what the hell? And three, were we robbed?
Well, I like SBS better than ABC. If we could only choose one of them, I'd choose SBS because I'm a soccer fan.
Yep.
And, you know, I don't mind government services that I like. So
when they pay for things I like.
Yeah.
But what's the old thing about lefties? Like, everything I like should be free. Everything I don't like should be banned.
Yeah. Yep.
I don't see the flaw.
Yeah, I mean, that's... Anyway, so SBS... No, I mean, obviously SBS should be prioritised. At least they run ads. What was the second one? I don't know. So, the bits I liked it... What was the second one?
I was just going to say, when do you reckon Optus live this down?
Wow, net. I mean, they've done... Soccer fans already hate them because they took the Premier League, but now they hate them even more because of this. I think.
But
like,
again, Pete, how could they have known people wanted to watch World Cup?
Yeah, exactly.
How could they have known Australia in an international tournament would be watched by people?
Exactly right. They didn't realise that... That the World Cup is actually watched by over half the world's population. So
is that true?
That, yeah. Yeah, I think so.
The biggest sports in the world is soccer.
Very true, Nina. Mm. Very true. So they've handed over the group games to free-to-air. So they still were going to come back for the rest of the tournament. I feel like you want to say something.
I was going to say, what would win head-to-head, the World Cup final or the Royal Wedding?
World Cup final.
World Cup final?
Yeah. Mm.
For sorry, sure.
Prince. Oh, well organised, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle. Well organised.
Malcolm Turnbull weighed in and said he'd spoken to Optus CEO Alan Liu. So, you know, he had all the big guns out trying to solve this problem.
A fly on the wall on that one.
Yeah. Couple of peanuts said this was proof that privatisation didn't work, which was an interesting take. That's all I've got. Oh, VAR. Yeah, so obviously this we're speaking the day after Australia got awarded the VAR penalty, which allowed us to draw with the Danes and keep us in the hunt for a spot in the second round.
So you're pro VAR.
Well,
until the next time that it robs us.
Swing
voter, Peter Gregory. What have you done for me lately?
Yeah, I'm a classic swing voter.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the camp of video replays ruin sport and bring back umpires actually making decisions.
It's nothing like a big error for a talking point. And yeah, there's still errors.
It gets you talking on a Monday.
There's still interpretation.
You don't need to tell me the video review still makes errors, okay? I go for Richmond. We've had like 7 goals taken away from us this year, and Shai Bolton was not spoiled in the dying seconds against GWS last year. I'm still not over
that. Oh, the ball, he didn't touch. Yeah. Well, yeah. Who cares? You won the flag.
Yeah, well, I care. Also, it ruins basketball, but we're talking about sport for too long again.
Nana?
Yes.
What's right. Your view?
Me, I'm anti-VAR.
Hey, there we go. Me and Nina. High five.
I love humans. Does that make sense?
Yeah, Nina loves humans.
That's nice.
Oh, that's quite...
Let's end on that.
Let's go there.
Yeah.
Cool. So that's it for the show this week. Thank you guys so much for listening. Thank you so much for subscribing. And thank you for waiting around because today was a hassle. But we got there. Thank you to Dr. Peter Hendy and Simon Brini for the interviews. They were really interesting stuff. Make sure you are subscribed on iTunes, SoundCloud, our website, through our Hey What an MS email. That's the way you can listen to this podcast. If you are subscribed on iTunes, make sure you're leaving that 5-star review if you like the show, and you can also leave a comment and a tip. Or maybe you can send in your own democracy manifest moment.
Yes.
Maybe another video that I could watch and that's really funny.
Segment ideas as well.
Segment ideas as
and
well.
And tell your friends. We got to 16.
Yeah, we got to 16... news and politics podcast recorded anywhere in the world, downloaded in Australia. So take that. Who did we beat? Ben Shapiro. We were beating Ben Shapiro at one point, so yeah. Eat it.
Well, I mean, obviously fellow traveller, but we're trying to get the top 10 and then obviously...
Is he in the room? Is he in the room?
Well, he might be listening. Traveler. He's probably listening if he knows what's good for him.
Yeah, for a few tips.
Because we're coming for you, Ben.
I
love you, Ben. Well, I don't know. Carrie, you finished the show, James.
We had such a good moment. Now we've declared war on Ben Shapiro.
Oh, no.
We're going to have a basketball tournament.
He's smarter than us as well. Like, we're in trouble.
We should challenge him in basketball like the Ted Cruz, Jimmy Kimmel thing. Did you see that?
I did not.
Oh, that was woeful. Ted Cruz and Jimmy Kimmel had a basketball one-on-one.
Mm.
And it was originally like 1st to 15, but they cut it when 1st to 11 because no one can hit a shot. And they're like, we've got other places to be.
We need to film the rest of the show.
All right. Where were we? Membership. That's it.
Oh, we're doing membership. Yeah. Hi.
Nina, you're still here.
I'm still here. I was just like, whoa, we lost it. Okay. Well, if you love our works and you'd like to become a part of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. Then starting as low as $22 per year, you can become a member.
Excellent. See you guys next week.
See ya.